You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Hello.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Ladies and gentlemen, how are you?
Jay is joining us after a two-week hiatus.
What have you been doing for 2 weeks, Jay?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Not sleeping. My wife and I had our baby girl, Olivia, on the 9th of September at 8:25 p.m. It was very easy the second time.
For you.
Well, it was always easy.
Oh, for her, too.
No, it really went fast. It was from the moment that my wife said, I think I'm having the real contractions, to when the baby came out, was two hours and 25 minutes.
Yeah, that's nothing. Wow.
That's nothing, dude.
Wow.
It was unreal.
Piece of cake. The third will even go even faster.
It was fun to have you guys call when the action was happening. That was really, really great night. You know, it's just so good to get past the hump of having the baby come out. Like, it's a little scary. You know, you have your spouse.
That's what causes problems.
Of course.
You know, in excruciating pain, and then, you know, that you see your newborn child come out, and everything is just like, is everyone okay? Is everyone okay? You know, so.
Now, imagine that happening in your living room.
Yeah. Kara, did you know that?
That was my second child.
I don't.
Yep.
Yes.
You had to pull the living room card, Steve, didn't you?
Yeah.
He trumps all.
I'm always going to play that card.
Come on. The trump card, yes.
All right, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
For this week's Superhero of Science, I'm covering Ruth Rogan Benedetto. She was a chemist who came up with the Easy Care cotton process, which may have saved the cotton industry and resulted in the wrinkle-resistant wash-and-wear clothing that we all enjoy tremendously today, especially me. And Benedetto was born in 1916, and she died in 2013, so she had a hell of a run. I was impressed with her parents. They were ahead of their time. Her father was a civil engineer, and her mom was a college-educated artist, an active feminist 100 years ago. Imagine how tough that was. Now, both of them encouraged Ruth's dream of pursuing science in an age when that would only be just a dream for many, many women. Her father made sure she had the same education as his boys and often told her, an education is something that can never be taken from you, which, of course, is a sentiment that will always be true unless, of course, we learn how to hack the human brain and can erase memories. But that's beside the point. So she graduated high school at 14. So she was clearly very, very smart. She entered college at 15, and she got a degree in chemistry and math and physics. Wow. She worked at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Laboratories in New Orleans in the early 50s, and she's best remembered, according to many, for saving the cotton industry, potentially, by inventing this easy care process. It's also called cross-linking, which is a chemical treatment for cotton to make it wrinkle-resistant. Now, this process joins the long-chain-like cellulose molecules. Now, cellulose is a polymer, so it consists of these long molecules, which make it a good fiber. But the hydrogen bonds are weak, so it can wrinkle very easily, and that's exactly why it used to wrinkle so easily. But by chemically inserting short organic molecules between the fibers, kind of like rungs on a ladder, it makes them much less prone to wrinkling. This was developed at a key moment in textile history. Synthetic fibers like nylon and polyester had just been invented in the 30s and 40s, and they caused a sensation. Now, of course, they weren't as comfortable or cool in the hot summers, but they did not need any ironing, which was a major, major convenience, and people were buying it in droves, and it was actually hurting the cotton industry. And so, I mean, who knows what would have happened if she didn't have that breakthrough at that time. But there are many people that are convinced that it significantly helped the cotton industry and potentially prevented it from going under. So, remember Ruth Rogan Benedetto. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing the use of sodium hypophosphite as the catalyst for the esterification of cellulose by maleic acid, you know, if it comes up.
Yeah, that's another one of those examples of technologies that, like, aren't sexy and aren't headline-grabbing.
Right.
But they actually have a pretty significant impact on our modern lives. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes the little mundane things, you know, have the biggest impact.
I despise ironing. Oh, my God. It takes I do it, like, twice a year when I really, really need it. And I don't know if those clothes aren't, you know, haven't been treated chemically properly, but some of them just wrinkle more than others to this day.
I iron my money.
I don't iron. Don't wear your money. I refuse to iron. I just don't do it.
You don't do it?
No, I steam.
Yeah.
I use
one of those. Okay.
Yeah, a little handheld steamer. It's so much faster.
I dry clean.
I dry clean too. That's mostly what I do.
Sends it out.
You can't dry clean everything.
Just
the stuff that would otherwise need to be ironed. My shirts, everything else we wash. But just to if you take them right out of the dryer and hang them up, you're fine.
Right.
Yeah, shirts are the only things. I get my shirts pressed. That's the only thing I do outside.
Well, usually dryers have like a wrinkle release switch, so that typically does fine.
Dryers are big steamers.
You gotta pull that out. Yeah, exactly.
That's why they work.
Hey, did you guys hear about the pharmaceutical company that jacked up the price of the cost of one pill of their medicine from $13.50 to $750 a pill?
Yeah, the CEO got destroyed
Death
on
threats?
Reddit.
Yes. People hate him.
Steve, I saw this all over Facebook. Every third article had that. And it had a goofy picture of some guy who looked kind of scummy. He's making a stupid gesture. And I couldn't even bring myself to even read it because I thought, well, that can't be right. I mean, come on.
That's right. That's totally true. Totally true. But there's, of course, a lot of complexity here. So the company is Turing Pharmaceuticals. I've alternately read that it's a U.S. pharmaceutical company and that it's a Swiss-based company. And then I found out that it has headquarters in New York and Switzerland. So I guess it's both.
Well, they have a U.S. division.
The CEO is Martin Shkreli, who is a young guy. That's the guy that you saw. He looks like he's in his low 30s. The Turing Pharmaceuticals is a startup that he started in 2014. They haven't developed any medications yet, as far as I could see. But what pharmaceutical companies will do is they will buy the rights to a drug and then they'll market it. And that's exactly what they did. They purchased the rights to a drug called Daraprim, which is the only FDA-approved drug for toxoplasmosis.
Have you ever had to prescribe that for anyone?
Sure, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, along with other anti-parasitic drugs.
Toxo is weird.
Yeah, it's for toxo. So toxoplasmosis is a parasite. It's pretty common. Most people, you know, like half the population or something like that will have some exposure to it, but usually doesn't cause an infection. But if you're immunocompromised, it can come out as an infection, as an opportunistic infection. So we usually see it in the context of HIV.
Don't you get it from AIDS. Cat poo?
Yeah, but again, most people just are colonized with it. Yeah. It doesn't cause an infection. Your immune system keeps it at bay. But if you're on chemotherapy or if you have AIDS, then it could become an opportunistic infection.
This a-hole raised the price like crazy.
5,500%. Yeah.
Percent.
$13.50 a tablet to $750 a tablet.
Why would he do that? Wait, I understand greed. I totally can relate to greed. Okay. But isn't that marketing death?
That's called a predatory sort of practice, you know. So he bought the only drug that's approved. Now, not the only one that is used to treat toxo, but the only, you know, one of the few drugs that is used and the only one that's approved in the U.S. anyway to treat it. This drug was approved in 1953, so it's been around for a while, but it's a quote unquote orphan drug, which means that not that many people use it. You know what I mean? It's not like for diabetes or high blood pressure or something where there's going to be millions of prescriptions. I've read that maybe 2,000 people get treated a year with this medication.
Oh. Well, how often? How often do you need to take it?
Well, if you have an infection, you take it for like a 6-week period, a 12-week period, whatever it takes to clear the infection.
6 weeks.
A pill
okay.
a day, maybe?
So how many thousands are we talking it would take then to do a course of this?
Yeah. So you would take it, you know, over the course of 6 to 12 weeks. And there's 2,000 people a year in the U.S. that use the drug.
And they're likely already infected with HIV. So they're spending a ton of money on medication already.
I bring that up partly to explain why there aren't generics available, because no one's going to bother, you know what I mean, to develop a generic drug that has such a small market. That's why after 60 years, it's still the only version of this drug. There's no generics available. So he bought a drug that had no competition, essentially, and then jacked up the price.
you know, incredibly. Now, of course, I mean, yeah, everyone reacts the same way, right? It's like you look at those numbers and it's just hard to wrap your mind around it or to even think of a possible justification that isn't scummy. I mean, it just sounds predatory from beginning to end. So Shkreli did give an interview where he tried really hard to defend his actions, to defend the company doing this. But I have to tell you, I watched the whole thing. I was really not convinced. I thought he came out as a slime bag. You know, even trying to defend himself, he just looked like this, you know, corporate executive who is just was unconvincingly trying to defend, you know, some pretty sleazy actions of the corporation.
He's not a doctor. He's not a scientist. He's a venture capitalist.
He was a hedge fund manager before this.
Hedge fund manager.
Yeah, which is, you know, some people say that's, you know, kind of a dodgy investment scheme.
Yeah, loose and fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's legal. It's perfectly fine. It's legal and everything. But, you know, whatever. It just means you're the kind of person who will go out on the fringe to make a profit. But anyway, so he was saying, and this is how he was justifying this increase. He was saying, we're going to use the money to research newer, better treatments for toxoplasmosis.
That's bullshit.
Okay.
That, you know what? Everybody knows that there's a cost built in when you buy drugs. There's the cost of the R&D of the, you know, original researchers developing the drug, of all of the different clinical trials. But this drug has been around since the 50s. This drug is already on the market. He bought it from another manufacturer, which means that none of that was built into that cost per pill.
Right.
This the type only cost, of an it's insane.
The only cost is the cost of purchasing it, which I haven't seen what the purchase cost was. And it's like it costs like a dollar a pill to make it. So the manufacturing cost is a dollar a pill. And then there's marketing, distribution. There are other costs built in. He claims that the companies who previously were selling it, because it was an orphan drug with such a small market, they were making no attempts to make a profit off of it. So they were selling it at a loss, and that's not a fair baseline to compare it to. Now he's just trying to sell the drug at a profit. And, you know, but of course, it's just again, it's still hard to just, if he had raised the price from $13 to like $30, then his defense would have made perfect sense. But $750 a pill,
you know,
that seems, again, that just seems predatory.
It feels like it goes to the heart of what a lot of people have a hard time with as it is, which is this idea of for-profit medicine, this idea of making money off of people when they're sick and making money, you know, of not just breaking even, of not trying to figure out a way to have a healthcare system that is more about keeping people healthy and keeping people able to afford their medication, but this idea of, you know, kind of hitting people when they're down.
I think it's perfectly legitimate to have a system where, you know, we pay for drugs and then the price of the drugs has built into it the cost of R&D, the cost of doing research, which could be millions of dollars. So yeah, they're not just breaking even on the on drugs that they're selling. They're making enough of a profit to fund their ongoing research so that they could always keep new drugs in the pipeline. So that, I think that basic system is fair, because otherwise somebody else would have to fund all that research, or we wouldn't have as many new drugs as we have. And the U.S. produces more new drugs than pretty much the rest of the world combined because that we have this system. But that's not to say that the system isn't broken in a lot of ways as well. And this is one. And what a lot of the critics are saying is what this shows is that the price of a lot of drugs is completely arbitrary. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. It's whatever the market will bear. So you can have a situation where a hedge fund manager makes a startup company, buys a drug, and then jacks up the price 5,000% because that's what the market could bear. And it's only really because of social media outrage that attention is being paid to this.
The market only bears this because you have no alternatives.
Right.
Well, doesn't insurance cover this, Steve?
That blows back on us.
Yeah, right.
Of course, it's insurance. The taxpayer wants to pay for it.
It's actually Americans who are going to pay for this, because other countries have limits on how much pharmaceutical companies can charge for their drugs. So that price, that $750 per pill, that's basically just in the U.S. He's not going to get that in any other country that has, you know, price control for pharmaceuticals. So the American consumer is the one who actually pays that.
Why won't the American consumer then buy their drugs overseas?
Yeah,
they will.
They will. They will. Yeah. They'll get exactly them from other countries, which then they tried to stop, put a stop to that, right? But that's part of that's why there are people going online and buying drugs from Canada. But then, of course, you get fake you know, online stores. Yeah, they're selling knockoffs, expired medication and whatnot. So it's you sort of go outside of the regulatory protections when you do that.
Right.
So that's
the
not
black market.
It's not a great system either. So, you know, the legitimate points are here. Again, personally, I don't say like we should scrap capitalism. You know,
you gotta
pay for it one way or the other.
But
you know,
the price gonna be cap doesn't seem like a bad idea.
But there's got to be some kind of controls in there so that it isn't completely arbitrary. This is just such a dramatic, obvious situation. But this kind of thing is basically how it works. It's just arbitrary. It's what the market could bear. It's also unfair that we're not competing internationally, that we're basically soaking up the cost of R&D for all these drugs because other countries are just saying we're not going to pay that much. And the company's like, okay, well, we could make all our money in America, so we don't care. You know, we'll, you know, take a minor profit in Europe because whatever, we'll make all our money in the US. So I think we need to figure out a solution to that, some kind of international pricing agreement where everyone sort of pays their fair share for the R&D, you know, the development costs of drugs, you know? Now, the update is that Shkreli announced that
he's dropping it by $3.
Raise the price.
He's going to drop the price. He didn't say to what. He's going to drop the price so that his company makes a small profit rather than this outrageous profit he was hoping to make, I guess, on this pill.
Well, yay social media. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what that shows, really.
Even after you read it and you hear his interview and you hear him defend himself, you still kind of come away with that. But, you know, I always try to do the mental exercise of what is the most charitable interpretation of everything that I could possibly come up with. And what I think is like I don't think he thinks he's a bad guy. Most people think that they're justified in doing what they're doing. I think he thought that this was just a legitimate business transaction in order to fund research into more drugs. This is how you're going to get his pharmaceutical company rolling. But what he wasn't considering is that he's not selling widgets. You know, this is a drug that sick people need, and it's part of the healthcare system.
Yes.
And it's their only choice.
Yeah. You can't just do that. You can't just treat it like a widget. You know, that's, I think, the problem. That was his miscalculation, and he got hammered for it.
Yep,
by you know, celebrities, by politicians, by everybody. Did you see the meme that was going around that just compared him to Jonas Salk? It was pretty bad.
It was a coffee era. I mean,
I wouldn't know Jonas.
The PR nightmare. PR nightmare.
This is gonna go on his tombstone. I mean, this is like gonna be on his tombstone. No one's gonna forget this.
He had like a really good week. He was like, I am gonna make bank. Like, he probably was like, this is easy, you know?
That's easy.
Well, it's a great story. It really is. It's like a coming of age type of story. You know?
But the other thing is, because my fear is that this becomes a Big Pharma is evil story.
When
in fact, these kind of practices are not typical of the pharmaceutical industry. Not to say that they don't do their shenanigans. They do. That's why we need to tightly regulate them and keep a careful eye on them. They need a watchdog because, of course, they try to work the system to make money too. That's what they do. They're corporations. But nothing like this.
This is rubbing it in everybody's face, basically.
Was extreme. This is not typical. And it, you know, shouldn't be used as an example of, you know, typical behavior in the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, I'm sure Big Pharma was pissed. This guy made everybody look bad. They're like, dude, we had a pact here, like under the radar.
That's right.
Right.
Weren't you at the meeting, buddy? Hey,
you can only raise it by 4,000%.
Exactly. Then people are going to get
pissed.
You
greedy bastard.
All right. Well, Kara, tell us about the tragically declining ocean populations.
So I'm so sorry. Why do you wind up with these
one more? I picked the most depressing story this week.
This made me feel awful.
I know. If you want to have a good cry, I recommend reading the new World Wildlife Fund report, the 2015 report called Living Blue Planet Report: Species, Habitats, and Human Well-being. It's you know what it is? It's sobering. I think that's a good word to use for it, but it's incredibly important because some of the things that I learned reading this are absolutely staggering. The reason that I was interested when I first saw this report pop up in my feed reader, and it really didn't get as much coverage as I expected, was because I recently finished Elizabeth Colbert's book, The Sixth Extinction. which is all about, you know, these major extinctions that have happened throughout geologic time and how we are really right smack dab in the middle of a massive one. And it does seem like we have it's a lot of aspects of it are by our own hand. And so I wanted to better understand a very critical and sensitive part of this sixth extinction, which would be our oceans. And this World Wildlife Fund report actually gives us some good information. So this is going to be a little bit statistic heavy, but I'll try and only pick the things that I think are really important. The first thing I think is important to understand when you're looking at this report is that, first of all, nearly 3 billion people, so a pretty good chunk of the global population, relies on fish as a major source of protein. And overall, fisheries and aquaculture assure the livelihoods of 10 to 12% of the world's population.
Wow.
We should also remember that 60%, so well over half of the world's population, lives relatively close to the coast, within 100 kilometers. And now here's the real kicker. So this is why it's important, because so many people rely on the oceans for food, but also for livelihood and also for economic growth in their regions, like tourism. Now, the way that they did this major study, which is the largest that's ever been done, is that the World Wildlife Fund, with a lot of different collaborating partners, developed what they called the Living Planet Index. And the Living Planet Index measured trends in 10,380 populations of 3,038 different vertebrate species. And they've been doing this year after year. So this is talking about kind of signature species across the globe and trying to see how they've been threatened. Now, overall, they've seen across the Living Planet Index a decline of 52% of these species between 1970 and 2010. So another way that they put it is that the population sizes of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish fell by half in about 40 years. What they specifically wanted to focus on in this study is the portion of that population which makes up the marine population. So the LPI, or the Living Planet Index for marine populations, which is based on 5,829 populations, so about half of the 1,234 mammal, bird, reptile, and fish species that they identified for this study, those show a decline of 49% between 1970 and 2010. So right around the same amount, almost half. So that's going to be what we're working with for most of these findings, is about a 49% reduction in mammal, bird, reptile, and fish species that are marine, that are oceanic. So, and this is this report this year is about twice as large as the report that they let out last year. They had a lot more data to work with. And so they think it's the most accurate thing anybody's done to date, even though we're still missing a lot of information when it comes to marine populations, because it's very hard to study. So here are some sort of index species that give us a good idea of the health of the oceans right now. And one of the major ones that's often used is Scrombidae. I had never heard that word before. I'm also not, by the way,
that's not
a fish eater.
The word of the week.
Yeah, it's not the word of the week, but you get a bonus just in this study. Scrombidae is basically the family that includes mackerels, tunas, and bonitos. So these are major sources of food from the ocean. And an index for Scrombidae based on data from 58 populations of 17 species showed a decline, you guys, between 1970 and 2010 of 74%. So when you hear people saying, like, soon there won't be any tuna left to eat, that's not hyperbole. 74% less Scrombidae in the ocean than there were just in 1970, you know, not long, just a few years before I was born. And for most people, something that, I mean, they remember 1970. It's not that long ago. So, okay, here comes another one that's just brutal. Sea cucumbers. And this is a really good, again, index population because it's quite sensitive. It's more recently been seen as a delicacy, and it also helps support a lot of different agricultural kind of cultures. In the Galapagos Islands, sea cucumber populations declined 98% between 1993, when the first legal fishery for sea cucumbers opened in the Galapagos, and 2004. In only 11 years, just in the Galapagos, almost all of the sea cucumbers were fished. And we also saw a very similar fall off in the Egyptian Red Sea between 98 and 2001, a 94% decline due to overexploitation. Now, there was a fishing ban that was introduced in 2003, but even after that fishing ban between 2002 and 2007, we saw another 45% decline in these populations, which shows that a lot of this is not being well managed, which we'll get into in a bit. Okay, so let's talk about some things that that we've all heard from the time we were little. Coral reefs are declining. We know this. Coral reefs are going away. But how dire is this situation? It's probably a lot more dire than you thought. Coral reefs, as we know, are basically like the Amazon of the ocean. They're the most biologically rich, the most biodiverse, and economically valuable ecosystem on Earth. And the crazy thing about coral reefs is that over 25% of all of the species in the ocean live in reefs, but they only cover 0.1% of the ocean. And so a comparison for that, which I'd never thought about before, all of the coral reefs on the globe cover about half the area of France. That's it. So 3/4 of the world's coral reefs are currently threatened, and at projected levels of warming and acidification, which are the two major problems facing it, don't get me wrong, overfishing, poor water quality, runoff, deforestation, coastal development, oil spills, all of these things are contributing to the loss of coral reefs, but especially because of global warming and the ocean acidification that's come from global warming and how sensitive these reefs are to acidification, the current projected levels show that coral reefs will probably be lost altogether by 2050, that we won't have any left. And so think about that. That's where 25% of the ocean populations live. We've also
are we over the cliff? I mean, no way back?
Not necessarily. So this is the crazy thing. You know, when we think about what is going on with our oceans, why are our oceans so threatened? Why are mangroves going away? Why is seagrass going away? Why are all of these species threatened? 72% decline in deep sea fish populations in the North Atlantic over the past 40 years. Like, why is this happening? Well, one, it's overfishing. It's unsustainable aquaculture. So even though we have started to say, you know what, we need to start fish farming, we've got to figure out how to produce this, a lot of places aren't doing it in a sustainable way. There's no oversight. It's climate change. It's extractives. It's drilling for oil and gas. And it's massive levels of pollution and CO2 that are going into the environment that are acidifying our oceans. So all of these things are contributing to just a massive die-off to probably one of the more sensitive indicators of biodiversity on the planet. But with some of the changes that we've made more recently, we can already see both stability and very quick turnaround and bounce back in a lot of these species. So I want to give you a couple of really promising examples so that we're not all like crying by the end of this conversation.
Please.
Yeah. So here's a really good example in the study. There is an area called the Map of the Coral Triangle, which sort of surrounds Malaysia to the Philippines. It surrounds Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and the Solomon Islands. So sort of this strip above Australia and up underneath Southeast Asia. And this area is being managed by a lot of different organizations. There's this governance that's working to try and protect the coral triangle. It's a really big initiative across these 6 different countries. And there is a really sensitive coral reef there, and individuals are starting to work very closely to try and have this area bounce back. And we're already starting to see really promising results where we're starting to see economic growth in these areas. We're starting to see a lot of flourishing reefs that we did not see before. And specifically, if we turn the corner and we look at a really interesting study that's going on in Mozambique. There are local fisheries there that have been doing something differently for 4 years. They have started working within sanctuaries that are overseen by the World Wildlife Fund and by another organization called CARE. And within 4 years of working, doing sustainable fishing in these marine sanctuaries, there have been a 300+% bounce back of species.
You know, Kara, it's not as simple as like, oh yeah, don't eat fish anymore, because that, then the people who rely on fishing for their income are going to suffer. You know, like it's got to be solved through other means.
And also, some people can't not eat fish. You know, and it's about way more than just fish. If we lose the coral reefs, we don't just lose all of the food from the coral reefs. We lose these barrier protections for coastal cities. So a hurricane hits, and it's, you know, significantly more damaging if the coral reef is no longer there.
Oh, wow.
And we lose these massive massive CO2 sinks. The reason that the ocean acidifies is because it takes in so much CO2. And so it's this negative feedback loop where the more die-off we see, the faster the ocean acidifies, and it just gets worse and worse. There's a lot of negative downstream effects of losing the biodiversity in the ocean that literally has nothing to do with our food supplies.
All right, Evan, I understand that you can tell me who I should vote for or for whom I should vote based upon their handwriting.
Well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it. Like we can tell you some things about the personality of the people who are running for president, in fact. I mean, that is if you ascribe to the practice of graphology,
mm-hmm.
in which you've got these people who claim that they can analyze personality traits of any given individual based on their writing, their handwriting, even just their signature. And one particular person, her name is Michelle Dresbold. She has gone ahead and analyzed the signatures of all the candidates in the upcoming presidential election, at least the ones who are still in the race. For example, Hillary Rodham Clinton. We all know who she is. Here's her analysis of her handwriting. Her handwriting is straight up and down. Vertical slants take a lot of control. It appears the handwriting of people whose heads rule their hearts. She also uses a combination of printing and cursive. This print writing is found in creative thinkers, artists, musicians, writers, attorneys, and speakers. Also notice that the Y in Hillary is a straight, firm downstroke. This is a strong downward stroke with no loop. It appears in the handwriting of a strong-willed people determined to reach their goals. Another one, for example, is Carly Fiorina. She makes her Y also straight and firm down, a person determined to make it in life. Her rightward slant shows that same passion. But the break between the I and the O in her last name indicates that she dotted her I immediately after writing it. And these breaks demonstrate that Fiorina is an intelligent, creative thinker. Her F is formal and a bit pretentious, showing that she likes to look clean and proper.
So in other words, the bullshit cold reading.
Yeah, exactly. This is all bullshit, right?
Thank you. Thank you very much. This made the news rounds recently, and she did this for all the candidates. And there's maybe not surprisingly, very little to say against this as far as it being total 100% BS. Graphology has been disproven, long time ago, and continues to be disproven. But despite that, someone like this, this person, does this for a living. She's hired by agencies, detective agencies. The U.S. Secret Service has used her for her analysis expertise, and she's appeared on all these talk shows. She's been on Fox News and CNN and Today Show and all these places, and they don't give it a critical thought whatsoever as to whether what she's doing is real or is absolutely bogus. Now, she is also, I have to say, at the same time, she is a forensic document examination expert. Now, that is actually a legitimate pursuit in which people who have this particular set of skills are brought in to determine whether or not documents have been forged,
mm-hmm.
which is an actual legitimate science-based endeavor. She's one of these people who does both. And unfortunately, she crosses the streams of science and pseudoscience.
Think about with something like graphology. It's always, I think, helpful to think about the set of scientific information that would be necessary in order to establish the basic claims here. Like, how does she know that a straight down Y correlates with any personality trait? They literally just made it all up. It's like sympathetic magic, you know what I mean? Where they're just saying, oh, it looks strong, so that means it's a strong personality, but It's nonsense. There's no published studies establishing all of the hundreds of little claims that get added up. It's like astrology. It's the same thing. It's how was it ever established that, you know, having retrograde Mercury up your ass or something, it correlates with something happening in your life. There's no basic set of knowledge about this. People literally just made it up out of whole cloth because it sounds good. That's it.
Good enough for me, Steve. That's cool.
Yeah,
I'm sure it works. I mean, why would people do it if it didn't work?
Yeah, right.
And it's been happening for a long time. There's evidence that dates back, for as long, they say, as writing has existed, this sort of tea leaf reading, in a sense, has gone hand in hand, pun intended, with handwriting analysis. So when you see that article out there making the rounds on Facebook, social media, wherever, don't buy it. It's utter bunk, disproven many times over.
Now, having said that, I've done handwriting analysis in the past on my patients.
And what are you? But you're looking for some sort, something.
You're looking for like hemispheric neglect or something, right?
Yeah, I'm looking. It could be a neurological finding. There are a number of things that might manifest in handwriting. One of the things that's very common is in people with Parkinson's disease, their handwriting gets very, very tiny.
Oh, really?
Because it's more controlled from the shakes.
Interesting.
Yeah, because they are not moving as much. You know, they don't have the fluid movement.
Gotcha.
So everything becomes really, really rigid, and the movements become small, and that manifests first in the handwriting. So I usually have them write a sample for me. You can just make the diagnosis almost off of the signature.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Casper. Now, Jay, I understand that you actually own one of their mattresses. Tell us about it.
I really, really like the mattress. It's made of latex foam and memory foam. It's hard to describe the experience from going from a spring mattress to a latex foam mattress. It's different, absolutely, but it is a very, very nice sleep. I really enjoyed it.
Mattresses, especially memory foam mattresses, are expensive. They can cost well over $1,500. But the great thing about Casper mattresses is that they only cost between $500 for a twin size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for the full size, and $850 for the queen size, $950 if you want to go with the king size mattress. Those prices are outstanding.
And I think the coolest thing about Casper mattresses is that they're completely risk-free. They offer free delivery and free returns within a 100-day period. So the mattress is going to be delivered right to your door. You get to sleep on it for 100 days. And if you decide that it's not working for you, you can still send it back.
What I like is that these guys have obsessively engineered this mattress. It's got just the right sink and just the right bounce, which of course is because it's made out of a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
Latex foam and memory foam. I knew someone was going to say that. And they are made in America. So get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/SGU. That's casper.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. Jay, you're going to finally tell us what makes conspiracy theorists tick.
I'm not going to actually, tell you that.
Wait,
but I'm going to.
They're not going to let you tell. They're not going to let you change that.
No, they can't. I can't tell you, Steve, because I've got too many of them in the room with me right now. This is a summary of several studies that I'm going to give you that kind of talks about different aspects of conspiracy theorists and, just trying to figure out why they behave the way they do, why they think the way they do. It's pretty interesting. It's a little surprising, to be honest with you. I didn't expect some of these results to be like they are. So, there's a team of scientists in Italy that research people who are active on conspiracy theory promoting news websites. And they tracked 1.2 million people, including their likes, their comments, and their shares. And they concluded that those people who strongly believed in alternative narratives tended to stay within their like-minded group. Not surprised, right? They stayed on the websites and pages that agreed with their existing worldview. And they rarely, those same people rarely went to more mainstream sites. And conversely, people who were more mainstream were found to visit websites they both agreed with and disagreed with. And they participated in debates in the comments section. So that wasn't surprising to me. That seems to make sense. However, in another study, researchers found that debunking campaigns You know, so these are campaigns that would try to educate people on something that's wrong, or that, you know, let's say that a skeptic would think is wrong. These would have a very small effect on changing a conspiracy theorist's mind. And of course, the first question is why? Why is that the case? Because users segregated in their echo chambers are not reached by the information. And that comes right from the researchers who did the study. They were saying that because they have segregated themselves so much, they're simply not receiving the latest and greatest information, so they don't get educated. They don't have any way of changing their mind because they're just reading the same old stuff over and over and over again. Okay, now that is not that surprising either, and I would even say that a lot of skeptics and anybody is guilty of these past two findings. Now, other groups have said that this one I find very interesting. Many people think that conspiracy theories come from people that have a bias, correct? Would you guys agree with that?
What do you mean by it? Everyone has a bias, so I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, meaning that that conspiracy theories would come from people who would believe the statement that nothing happens by accident, as an example. This was one of the terms that these researchers were saying, listen, going on the idea that conspiracy theorists may tend to believe that the statement nothing happens by accident is true, right? Or things that seem to make sense, that there are powers behind the scenes making things happen, right? Conspiracy theorists are also thought to find meaningful information, say, from a random loosely associated event or events that have zero connection to each other, right? So these statements seem to be true about conspiracy theorists. I mean, I my own bias against conspiracy theorists tells me that that's exactly what they do. They find any connection, any tenuous connection that they can, and they build on that. And then they continue to build on tenuous connections with tenuous connections. And it keeps going on and on and on forever. The researchers at the University of Fribourg in Switzerland studied these concepts to see if their suspicions were correct, which was great. But they absolutely did believe that those suspicions were correct. And they concluded that after three studies, they failed to confirm their hypothesis. In fact, they found that the conspiracy believers' and non-believers' perceptions of randomness were indistinguishable from each other, that both groups were almost identical, and they considered them to be both normal, following a algorithmic information framework. That shocked me completely. It shocked the pants right off of me. I did put my pants back on after I read that.
But all that means, though, Jay, is that conspiracy theorists aren't conspiracy theorists because they have an inherent tendency to see patterns in noise greater than the background population, right? It just means that there are other processes going on, and the authors said maybe higher level processes, not sort of basic subconscious functioning, but there's something more complex going on that's driving conspiracy theorists. That's actually consistent with other research. Other research into conspiracy ideation or conspiracist ideation finds that it's a worldview. You know, it's not just a basic tendency. It's an elaborate worldview.
Yeah, but doesn't that relate to the idea that nothing happens by accident sentiment?
Not necessarily. So here are some, there have been a couple of the studies, because I was looking into this as well to see what I could find about it. Here are some personality traits that correlate well with conspiracy thinking. One is having higher political cynicism, greater support for democratic principles, more negative attitudes to authority, low self-esteem, and lower agreeableness. You'll notice that none of those things are directly related to pattern recognition. They're more higher level worldview types of things. You know, you're cynical about politics. You know, you think that, you know, you're probably more libertarian and that individual freedom is more important, negative attitude towards authority. And I think in conspiracy thinkers, that develops into a full-blown worldview where that becomes their explanatory model for everything. And then what they say is that as you said, that each individual conspiracy theory builds off the others. Because they have one conspiracy theory about the government, that supports other conspiracy theories about UFOs or whatever, because they already think that the government's engaged. There's a shadow government, so that's why they can hide the UFOs and the count, you know, the chemtrails and all. It all fits together into this one coherent worldview based upon the massive conspiracy theory.
Is it common that conspiracy theorists are like apply that kind of thinking to everything, or are there, you know, flavors of conspiracy theorists?
Generally speaking, they tend to believe in all conspiracies, you know. But I guess it depends on which ones you study, you know. If you spend your time on. If you went out of your way to include conspiracy theories that really had nothing to do with each other, maybe they won't overlap in their worldview. But if it at all involves being suspicious of the government, absolutely, you know, they'll go for it.
That's what makes me wonder where conspiratorial thinking sort of passes over into pathology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we think about how young psychology students will read the DSM and be like, I have everything in it, because of course everything's kind of on a continuum and you need to satisfy certain diagnostic criteria. So I've always wondered, you know, when you think of delusional thinking and you think of some of the criteria in schizophrenia, that conspiratorial, I don't trust the government, people are after me type of thinking, that persecutory, that's not a word, but feeling persecuted.
Persecutorial, I think is the word.
It is a word. Oh, good. That persecutorial thinking is rooted in that, right? So where do we see that kind of line get crossed?
Yeah, guys, we're all on the spectrum. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, and there is no sharp, bright line. And I guess there's a lot of other factors that go into it as well, many cultural. I also think that it's exposure, and some of the studies show that it's exposure, that if you have somebody that has even just a little bit of a tendency towards conspiratorial thinking and they get exposed to it, it could start to develop. And it's a belief system, so you can inherit a belief system culturally like you can any religion. You know, it really does become a religion in a way. It becomes this coherent worldview through which they filter all of their beliefs, and it's held onto with religious fervor, certainly. I think what this latest study is supporting, that understanding of conspiracy thinking. So it's actually consistent with previous research. And we're starting to see, you know, a bit of a coherent theory about what drives conspiracy theorists, which is interesting. All right, well, let's move on. Jay, we're a couple of weeks behind on Who's That Noisy?
That is true. So do you guys remember the last Who's That Noisy?
No.
No.
Not even close.
Was it a blaster? I it was don't. A blaster, wasn't
wow,
it?
Wow, Kara, I am, you know, becoming more impressed with you as time goes on. Yes, it was a blaster. And the blaster sound was... Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, gosh. It's like it was 2 weeks ago.
All right, so...
Damn, I know it.
I don't know, but for some reason, the words by your command...
Yeah, that's right. Robotron?
Oh, nice.
Cylons.
Oh, Cylons.
Yes.
So two weeks ago, Jason H. wrote in and guessed correctly. That is the Battlestar Galactica hand blaster that the good guys were holding.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the good guys, yes.
That's a very classic sound, and the thing that makes it unique is that it has like an after blaster noise.
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason why I think we remember it so well.
Oh, clearly, yeah.
That brings us to this week. Now, Kara, you probably won't know this.
Quite likely.
I want everyone else to keep their mouths shut.
Okay.
Evan.
Oh, God.
Oh, is that just like super easy to you guys?
It's a little bit trickier than...
That's a good one, man. I like that.
But yeah, that's a great one, by the way. Yeah, there was so many to pick from. I picked that one. I would like everyone to write me in and tell me what you think that is. Be specific. Don't just name the movie or the TV show. I want some absolute specificity. Would you write in? Thank you. Kara, if you care to do some research, you could probably figure this one out after watching, you know.
Stuff.
No, you just have to watch every sci-fi movie and TV show and you have a week.
That's right. Yeah, it's called binge watching. Have you ever heard of it?
Kara, I'm developing a little dream here. My dream is that you wake up and you're in my house and you walk downstairs and I'm like, you can't leave until you watch like the 30 hours of what I consider to be the core.
The core.
Just the core.
I don't know if that's like a dream or a nightmare.
It's both, apparently.
It's a dream.
For Bob, it's a wet dream.
Yeah, so write me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.
All right, thanks, Shay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, the word. There's a word. What's the word this week? The word is efferent, not to be confused with afferent. Right. But I think to understand efferent, you have to understand afferent. Now, Steve, I know you know this word. Yeah. I want to know about the other guys.
Let me just say, we usually pronounce it efferent.
Ooh,
but do you?
But I think that's because we just want to make sure it's absolutely clear that we're not saying afferent.
So I will tell you that in the South, I have never heard that pronunciation.
No, that's. I think that's just a.
It's an East Coast.
Even though we know it's like maybe it's grammatically incorrect.
Gotcha.
It's just to be absolutely clear, efferent and afferent, make them sound as different as possible. Different as possible, yeah. So they don't get confused.
I have literally never heard I've never heard anybody say efferent. That is so strange.
Could be institutional, but although.
Could be institutional too. I am going to have a hard time doing that. Efferent. Efferent.
Well, Steve, it makes sense in your profession because you know, a misheard word could mean the difference between life and death.
That is definitely true.
Absolutely.
Because this is a word that we use in, obviously, research all the time as well, and it's probably less likely that you will cut the wrong thing research setting.
Efferent, that's, yeah.
Yeah, they do sound very similar.
Efferent and efferent is just, you know, makes it more distinct.
Wait, what the hell is the word this week?
I don't know what the word leg. You're supposed to amputate the right leg.
Efferent or efferent refers to, guys, do you want to take a stab at it?
I think I know what it is.
Projecting out or something.
Yeah.
There you go, Jay.
It's the law that they passed in New York to make sure that the landlords don't raise rent.
No. But Bob, you said you thought you knew. Evan said it in the background, but you might not have heard him.
No, I didn't. Something that extends away or outwards or something like that. Moves away.
Exactly.
Yeah. I said projecting outward.
Yeah.
Projecting outward, extending outward, conveying or conducting away or outward. Specifically, this is a word that's used in physiology as it relates to a body part or an organ. And more specifically, it's almost always referred to when we're talking about blood vessels or nervous tissue. So I learned the words efferent and afferent in all of my neuroscience courses. And I remember being very confused, just like many students in anatomy and physiology are, because it's very hard to keep them straight and they do sound very similar. So if we think about where they come from, it's a little bit easier to keep them straight, which is why I think etymology is always so important, especially when you're learning medical terminology. So they come from the Latin effere, or effere, if we want to say it that way, meaning to carry away or bring forth. So if you break that down, they come from eff, or eff, which is synonymous with ex, which means out of or like from within. And then fear refers to bearing or carrying. So when those two things are combined, it's bearing or carrying out of, or bearing or carrying from within outward. And this was first used in medical texts in 1827. Now this is, as we said, in contrast with afferent from the Latin affere, which means to carry toward. The reason we used to get confused, and I think a lot of people do, is you think of it as being away or toward. And so you want to say that afferent is away, but it's not. Efferent is away and afferent is toward. So I was looking up online some memory devices that different students have used when they were trying to understand it. And I found a really good one on that a student submitted to Yahoo Answers. So think of it this way. When we think of an efferent nerve fiber, it's a nerve fiber that's sending signals from the central nervous system away towards the peripheral nervous system. So a good idea of an efferent nerve fiber would be one that's sending information to the muscles. So a motor neuron is talking to the muscles. So they were saying efferent for exercise, your muscles exercise. And then an afferent nerve signal is one that often will bring sensory information toward the central nervous system. So they said that they remembered afferent for aroma, as you smell an aroma and it brings it into the brain. So I thought that was interesting.
Very cool.
Device that you could use.
So is that related to effervescent?
I don't think so. And it's also not related to affect or effect. So that's the other thing. A lot of times grammatically, people get affect and effect confused, or affect and effect, which are basically the same word but used grammatically differently. Of course, affect is also a word used in psychology and neuroscience to refer to, somebody's kind of behavior, the mask that they're wearing, sort of. So it's not related to either of those words either. So that's why this is a very confusing word. And anatomical distinctions are often, I think, for students, one of the hardest things to understand, because it's hard to compare it to a root. In this case, I think knowing the Latin really helps you understand how to use the word.
Right. In medical school, you pretty much have to just commit all that stuff to memory. I mean, you have to know it cold. If you're, digging into a mnemonic, you don't have it. You know what I mean? You just have to know it. It's like things like distal, proximal, caudal, cephalic. I mean, you just have to know what all of those things mean. Dorsal, ventral.
Why do they give it weird words, Steve?
Because they mean something very specific. It means something very specific. You know what I mean? Like distal means farther down along some extremity, right? Like your fingers are distal to your shoulder. But you can't really see anything else. Nothing else really would work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Other than distal is really the only word that actually captures the exact anatomical relationship.
Gotcha. So it's kind of like how the Eskimos have like 100 words for snow.
Yeah, which I think is a bit fallacious. But
which isn't true, but I'm just saying. Yeah.
All right. We're going to do a quick email this week. This comes from Wolfwing in Canada. If that is
Wolfwing.
Wolfwing.
I like it.
If that is your real name.
And this city of hers.
Who writes, you talked about the classic great question, what could change your mind about X, and that we should always be open-minded. Thing is, there is one thing I don't think, least from my perspective, I could ever accept as possibly true, and that's God. It goes to the title, The Problem of Q. Bob, you ever heard that phrase, The Problem of Q?
No, actually,
Do you know what that refers to?
Well, based on this email, I do now.
Yeah, the Q from the Q continuum from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Cool.
He continues, which is a similar thing to the Arthur C. Clarke quote, any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. Of course, the reverse is true. Magic would be indistinguishable from sufficiently advanced technology. What could a god do that couldn't be either done by a being such as Q or faked with high technology? The Enterprise can either do most things a god could do or fake with things like the holodeck and such. Even if everything in the Bible were 100% true, how could we ever be sure it wasn't just some Q-like being screwing with us? So, that's a really good question. I completely agree with your line of thinking there. I've made that exact argument myself. I can't remember if I've done it on the show before or not. But basically, and I know I've written about it before. And essentially, the problem of Q is that if you hypothesize a being that is outside of the laws of the universe, how can a being like a human who is constrained by those laws ever be able to evaluate evidence which demonstrates the existence of the being outside those laws of physics? And the answer is you can't. As humans, we will never, ever, ever, even in principle, be able to know whether or not a god like, the God of the Bible exists, a being that could create the universe that's not constrained by the laws of the universe, because we are. And because all it would take is another being who is sufficiently advanced beyond us in technology in order to be able to fake us out. And there was no experiment we could do, no observation that we could do, nothing we can do to distinguish between an advanced alien and God. So we could essentially never have knowledge of God's existence. You can have a feeling, which people, I think they often say, I have personal knowledge of God. What they really mean is they have a feeling, but of course those feelings could be self-deception. They could arise from 100 other things, or again, it could just be a powerful being, but not God, who's messing with you. I always remember that quote from McCoy, who said, I'm going to paraphrase, like, one day I'd love to beam down to a planet with a primitive culture and say, behold, I am the Archangel Gabriel. Right. He's just saying, with the Enterprise's technology, you could pretend to be an angel or a god or whatever,
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get in frustrating conversations with people a lot who try to talk about evidence for spirituality or evidence, maybe not spirituality, but evidence for supernatural things. And by definition, right, science is the study, the interrogation, the documentation of the natural world.
Yeah.
And once something becomes supernatural, it no longer falls within the purview of science.
Exactly. Yeah, I wrote about that as well, that exact question. So you can expand it to all things, quote unquote, supernatural. At best, let's say something that fit the definition of supernatural existed, which would be weird because then it would be natural, but whatever. If you have to come up with some kind of definition, it's beyond the laws of physics that as we could ever know them, let's say, whatever. The best we could hope to find is an anomaly that we could never explain. That would be it. We'd never be able to prove that something is actually supernatural. All you could demonstrate is that you have an anomaly, something you can't explain naturally, and that anomaly will never be solved. But of course, you never know that, right? Because there's always more time. Somebody may explain it next year or in 10 years. Unknown does not mean unknowable. You can't prove that something is unknowable. Right. All you could do is say, we don't currently know the answer. We can't currently explain it. So again, you could never know that something supernatural exists. All you can have are anomalies, which is, of course, why proponents of things that are miraculous or supernatural, that's what they do. They anomaly hunt. They talk about anomalies. But anomalies aren't evidence of a specific thing. They're just evidence that we don't understand. That's it.
And there's been plenty of anomalies in science and especially physics and things that were a complete mystery for years, decades, or even centuries that you could have said, oh, that's supernatural. Yep. We can't explain it. But eventually, many of them have been explained.
Yeah, history shows, yeah, in the long term, we're pretty good at explaining those anomalies. So that's a pretty good bet so far.
The interesting thing I think about this Q problem is that for some people, I think more progressive yet interested in still finding spirituality thinkers, there's no difference between their concept of God and this concept of, for example, a more evolved being that is messing with us. I've definitely heard a lot of people discuss this idea of living in a simulation.
Yeah.
You know, we saw the recent study, not so recent anymore, out of Washington State, where researchers managed to simulate a teeny tiny portion of the known universe on these massive supercomputers. And they were saying if we extend that out and we were actually able to simulate a large portion of the universe, who's to say then that we're not being simulated?
Right.
And of course, when I interviewed them, I asked the question, well, then who's simulating us? Hoping they wouldn't say God. And their response was us in the future.
Oh, yes. I like that one. Yeah, that's a cool one.
You know, but the reason why I know we're not in a simulation, because like I wouldn't have picked like some of the problems I got to deal with. Like it's not fun.
But what
you know?
If you're not the one simulating yourself?
That's not acceptable.
Random life.
That is not acceptable.
Random life.
What if Bob
generation?
Is simulating you?
If
Jay,
Bob
you
was no, I know Bob is certainly not simulating us because it would be the flip. Halloween would be 11 months a year.
Yeah, Jay, I think you could predict a lot of things about the universe that I would simulate, and this is clearly not it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. You know, it's one of those things where once you truly get that concept that, in a sense, God can't ever be known for certain.
Yeah.
Even though I don't believe in God, there is something unnerving about that thought.
It doesn't bother me.
Doesn't bother me at all either. It's like, yeah, there's just we can invent stuff that we could never know if it's true or not. And so it's of absolutely zero value. You know what I mean? It's just the idea is not useful to anything. So you just put it aside, you know?
Yeah. What did James Randi always said? You can't prove that there are no unicorns in Ecuador.
Yeah. It doesn't get you anywhere. So I just put it out, you know, just put it aside.
It's when people ask, you know, why don't you call yourself an agnostic? That's always my answer, that we're all agnostic. We're either theistic or atheistic agnostics.
Yeah.
But it's by definition unknowable. So you just live your life a certain way.
Right.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
I think you'll be amazed and intrigued. Okay. The three items this
week.
In
that order?
Yeah.
I'm never ready, but I'm always excited.
All right, good. Here we go. Item number one. Researchers have discovered a new layer of code with the DNA genetic code that determines the type of proteins that are made. Item number two. New fossil evidence shows that the first Australians lived alongside and probably hunted giant predatory lizards the size of small elephants. And item number three. A major worldwide effort to replicate STAP, or stimulus-triggered acquisition of pluripotency, has completely failed, falsifying this simple method for creating pluripotent stem cells. Jay, you've had a break for a couple of weeks, so why don't you go first?
Well, the one about DNA, that's really interesting, like a new layer of data. Ugh, that is cool. I mean, sure, I could see that. Okay, if any continent is going to have gigantic predatory lizards that people were fighting. Of course, yeah. It's Australia, and I want to believe this so bad because it's so cool. Oh, God, that's really cool, Steve. I really hope that one is true. Giant predatory lizards. Small elephants. Well, wait. Now, elephants can come pretty small, Steve. This one is riddled with problems. I'm going to go on to the last one. And the third one about replicating the STAP, the stimulus-triggered acquisition of pluripotency. Whoa, that's a mouthful. Okay, and it said it failed. Damn, that would suck. All right, Steve, I have to go with the lizards just because I don't think that life is that cool. I don't think it ever was that cool with people fighting giant predatory lizards.
Okay, Kara?
Okay, I am going to agree with Jay about the layer of code because we know about the genome, we know about the proteome. I think that having understanding, there's so much DNA that we still think doesn't code for anything, that we still don't understand what it codes for, that looking in that noise, I think that it's likely that researchers have maybe found something new. So I'm going to be hopeful on that one. I think that Australians did live alongside giant predatory lizards, only because island gigantism is a legit thing. Like, it happens in evolutionary biology. Things go to islands and then they get big and big and big and big. And I don't know, seems realistic to me, but that would mean that STAP, a major worldwide effort to replicate it, has completely failed, falsifying the simple method for creating pluripotent. I don't know. That's like one of those, if they ever say all or none, it's most likely false. Maybe it kind of failed. Maybe it was replicated. I didn't read anything about this. So I'm going to say that the effort to replicate STAP is the fiction, and maybe some lab actually was able to replicate it.
Okay, Evan.
A new layer of code within the DNA genetic code, determining the type of proteins that are made. That's probably the one I have the least feelings about, because I just don't know anything about this one. Fossil evidence, the first Australians lived alongside and hunted giant predatory lizards. But the size of small elephants, well, size is relative. May sound more impressive than it actually is, which made me kind of believe that this one was true. New fossil evidence, sure, we're always learning new stuff based on the fossil evidence that we're discovering. And then STAP, stimulus-triggered acquisition of pluripotency. It failed. Boy, I tend to go with Kara on this about thinking that this one might be false or the fiction. To think that, boy, a worldwide effort, it's either that or the DNA genetic code one. Hell, I'll spread it. Hell. For no other reason, I'm going to spread it out. I'll say the DNA genetic code one. I'll say that one's the fiction because I have no feelings whatsoever. The other ones seem somewhat plausible.
And Bob?
I'm going to say that the DNA genetic code is, that sounds reasonable to me. I don't think it's necessarily within the so-called junk DNA. I think it's some other way that proteins are made, something about their production that we hadn't anticipated. So that one seems okay. First Australians, the lizard, yeah, let me get back to that one. The STAP, I just don't know about that. I'm just naturally skeptical about that because of all of the fraud that's been in there. So I'm just naturally skeptical, and I really want something like that to be true. So I'm going to say that hopefully is true. The huge lizard, I mean, I just think I would have heard something. I just never heard of a lizard that big that existed when people were around. Now, I know there were plenty of megafauna around when we were here, but That one, you know, wouldn't surprise me either way, but I'm going to go with Jay and say that one's fiction.
All right, so you guys are all spread out, so there's no reason not to take these in order. So we'll start with the first one. Researchers have discovered a new layer of code within the DNA genetic code that determines the type of proteins that are made. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science, and this one is science. Sorry, Evan.
Yeah, baby. All right.
So this is cool. The details here are pretty interesting. Cool. Yeah, but I can always tell, Bob, when you've read the item because you give like this perfect, you know, but vague description.
No, I could have been so much more perfect.
But yeah, so this is interesting. This is true. Now you guys know the basics of like what the genetic code is. You have the three nucleotides, A, T, G, C. They code for an amino acid. There's 20 amino acids that make up proteins. And there's 4 cubed or 64 different possible trinucleotide codes. So there's more codes than there are amino acids, right? So think about it. It's a three. There are four letters and there are words made up of three letters, right? Three. There's four different letters and the words are made up of three. And there's 64 different words, but there's only 20 amino acids they have to code for. There's also a couple of like stop codons. You know, like you have to say when to stop transcribing the protein, but that allows for some redundancy. So there's like two or three different codes for each amino acid. For a long time, scientists thought that that was it. That, you know, if you have three different codes, for example, that each code for lysine, that they're completely interchangeable in the DNA. It doesn't matter which one of the three codes you use, they all code for lysine. So the sequence of amino acids is unchanged. Now, it has been previously discovered, so this isn't a brand new idea, it's been previously discovered that the different, you know, swapping out one code for another code for the same amino acid may affect the copy numbers, like how much of a protein gets made. Right, the expression of the protein. But now the new researchers have found that it's not just that, it could actually affect the protein itself. But I have to clarify the terminology. So a protein is determined by two things, the sequence of amino acids and how it gets folded up three-dimensionally. Now, if I had said polypeptide, that would have been wrong. A polypeptide is just the sequence of amino acids. But a protein is a specific shape so that you only get to the protein after you fold it up in a specific way. So what the researchers discovered was that when you swap out different codes for the same amino acid, it affects how quickly that amino acid gets added to the polypeptide when the protein is being made, and that the speed with which the protein gets made affects how it folds. So it actually can fold into a different protein, even though it has the same amino acid sequence. Does that make sense? And that could change its functionality. So you actually can get a different protein just because you have, you know, either you're changing the speed with which the protein is being made, which changes how it gets folded up in three dimensions. And
that's cool.
That's affected by these differences, these otherwise silent differences. They're silent in terms of the amino acid sequence, but it turns out they're not so silent when it comes to protein folding and the rate at which proteins are made. Fair. It's like this other layer of code hidden in the genetic code.
Yeah, that seems fairly fundamental. That's amazing that at this point we could discover yet another layer of coding in there. It's incredible. What else is there that just is so subtle that we haven't even seen it yet?
Right. All right, let's move on to number two. New fossil evidence shows that the first Australians lived alongside and probably hunted giant predatory lizards the size of small elephants. You know, by small elephants, I mean like more like the Indian elephant rather than the African elephant. Have any of you guys ever heard of the Megalania monitor lizard?
Ooh, I'm looking it up right now.
Megalania
monitor. Yeah, I was thinking of the monitor lizard, but that's still, you're talking, what, five times bigger than a monitor lizard or more?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're talking a huge monitor lizard.
So this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Damn. Oh, no. Well, Evan, if you had gone with me or not, you still would have lost.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, my two choices were both wrong.
But what they did find, what they found was an osteoderm. An osteoderm is, as the name implies,
a bone.
bone skin?
Yeah.
Bone skin?
It's little bits of bone. It's like plated. And like basically forming the hard, scaly armor of certain large lizards. And they found some. This is not an unusual fossil to find in Australia. But what surprised the researchers was that it dates to a time that overlaps with when the first Australians were there. And it has never been previously demonstrated that the first Australians overlapped with the giant lizards of Australia. That they didn't find a skeleton. They can't identify the species. They just found the osteoderm. It's possible that the osteoderm comes from a monitor lizard, which is just but no bigger than the monitor lizards that are around today, which are still big boys. These are like the biggest living, you know, extant lizards. They're like as big as a large dog, maybe a little bit larger.
So it wouldn't have been a megalania.
But it could have been a megalania. It could have been. That would be even more interesting. They just don't have the full skeleton. They just have this, you know, this bit of ectoderm, of osteoderm. But the megalania did not get as big as an elephant. I made that part up. They can be as big as 7 to 9 meters, but that includes a very long tail. They look like a large crocodile. If you think about that, like even larger than like a really big crocodile, but not much. If you look at their overall size, their legs, they stand a little bit higher than the, you know, than the crocs do.
It looks like it was like waist high.
Yeah. Like its back would be right around your belly button. Yeah. The top of its back.
You could ride it.
Yeah. And it would be 7 to 9 meters long, but including that long tail. So maybe like 3 meters if you're including the snout to the back legs and then even more length in the tail itself. So still definitely a big boy. And these definitely would have been scary to run across because they were predators. You know, again, this would have been like just a super big crocodile, that kind of creature.
I would have totally like befriended them when they were born and trained them.
Yeah.
To follow me.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that would have worked. That would have worked.
And I would have painted them all different colors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I would have been pretty epic back then.
So it's possible that Australians overlapped with those creatures, but that remains to be seen. But yeah, I exaggerate on the size. And there's no evidence of hunting. Again, it was just an osteoderm. So, but all this means that a major worldwide effort to replicate STAP, stimulus triggered acquisition of pluripotency, has completely failed, falsifying the simple method for creating pluripotent stem cells. That is science, which means that
sad.
It isn't science because they didn't replicate it. So this is interesting. So what the original study showed was that by doing simple things like treating cells with an acid bath, that you would flip the genes, you know, that were responsible for pluripotency, meaning that, you know, again, a stem cell or a pluripotent stem cell could turn into many other kinds of cells. So these are very useful in research. They are potentially very useful in therapeutics. That's still, you know, something that's being developed. And so the ability to like take your skin cells and then turn it into a pluripotent stem cell is nice. And we could still do that. I don't want you to think that all of stem cell science is fiction. Just this, when this was just like the simplest method, these researchers were claiming that they could do it with just these very simple techniques, and it would convert the cells. It was met with immediate skepticism, and then other labs tried to replicate the techniques, and they couldn't. And then the researchers always say, "Well, that's because you're not doing it right," you know, as opposed to the technique doesn't work. So they say, okay, well, we have to settle this once and for all. This is a huge, important question. If their claims are correct, if this procedure works, this is a major boon to stem cell research.
Yeah.
And if it's a dead end, if it doesn't work, we have to figure that out so we stop wasting any resources on it. So they formed a multinational research consortium, basically, to say, all right, we're going to all try really hard to replicate the various aspects of this STAP process. And multiple labs, you know, like trying to replicate each part of the technique and really doing a deep dive on it. And what they found out was that it was completely unreplicatable.
So are we talking fraud then? Was this the original?
No, no. So here's an example. Yes, incompetence.
Ugh.
Here's an example. One of the genes that is a consistent marker of pluripotency is the OCT4 gene. And they say when this gene is active, you get a green fluorescent protein, right? It or there's a green fluorescent protein that activates when OCT4 is present. So you can use the green fluorescent protein as a marker to see if you have an active OCT4 gene. So the researchers found it, and they concluded that it was the OCT4 was present, therefore it's a pluripotent stem cell. However, there are other proteins that will spontaneously fluoresce, and you have to use filters to get rid of this background noise of fluorescence. And when you do that, it doesn't work. So they were just picking up background noise and then falsely interpreting it as the marker for this one gene of pluripotency. So that's a pretty specific technical problem that the original researchers did, which created their false positive results. They didn't use the proper filters, and they were interpreting noise as signal. So then again, this, you know, highlights, I love these kinds of stories, even though it's disappointing, but it highlights why we have so much faith in the overall process of science. Because first of all, these scientists wanted to know what was really, really true. They weren't willing to accept a result just because it was really amazing and useful and they could do research on it. They wanted to know, you know, wait, we have to figure out if this is really true or not. And then they did what scientists do. They really replicated it in detail, looked at all the ways in which the original experiments could have gone wrong, and they found out that they couldn't replicate it, and the results, this is the self-correcting nature of science.
Yes. And this is action. And this is how alternative medicine research should behave. Don't do experiments that tell you the details of some alternative medicine. The first thing you got to do is absolutely show that there's a real thing there, and they just skip that. They
does
don't
it
do
exist?
It.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't tell me how it works before you tell me that it exists.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't do the kind of research that's designed to disprove their theories. You know, they design their studies to prove them, sometimes even overtly saying that they're doing it. You know, they don't even realize that that's not the way science works. But yeah, I agree. This is not what you see. And also, this is just in the face of all of the conspiracy theorists or the science deniers who like to say things like scientists are closed-minded and they're dogmatic and, you know, whatever. They're just, once you believe something, you can't question it. And, you know, just it's ridiculous. The everyday process of science belies all of those claims. You know, this is day-to-day standard procedure. This one is news because it's stem cells, and this is a really important claim. But disproving and discarding failed procedures and theories and ideas is just a day-to-day science.
And the stakes were really high. This sounds similar to me a little bit to Bicep 2. It was something that everybody was very excited about. There was a finding that the scientific community was really hoping was true, but they weren't going to stop and say and just rule out any alternative. They were like, we need to systematically go through these alternatives, and they realized there was noise.
Yeah. Or the superluminal neutrinos.
Right.
Neutrinos going faster than light. They realized the stakes were high. Like, guys, you know, God, you got to – show us where we went wrong.
We got to be sure.
Show us where we went wrong. And they did. They said, yeah, you got your timing was off in the wire, whatever it was.
Got to carry the two.
Yeah, it wasn't that. But yeah, there's, you know, science is hard. You know, these little technical things can sometimes throw off your results. And you've got to turn over every stone.
Like the microwave running in the other room. Hey, what's that noise? Hey, we can't figure this out. Coffee's ready, guys.
Joe's burrito.
Yeah. It's the difference between just trying to prove your beliefs versus really, really wanting to know if something is true or not. And going to extreme lengths, you know, to prove it one way or the other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because your job is to attempt every way that you can to disprove it. Uh-huh. Let's try and figure out all the ways I could be wrong, and that's the only way I'll know if I'm right.
Tentatively, at least for now. Yeah.
Exactly. That I'm tentatively right.
It has
exactly.
to be part of the process. Yeah,
if this were alternative medicine, people would they would not believe these results, or they never would have been carried out. They would have already been selling therapies that that deal with these. They would have just gone full bore ahead with all the bullshit before the basic shit was done first.
Exactly.
Well, they probably already are. I mean, there already are. Right.
That's what they are doing. Alternative stem cell treatments.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Don't get me started. All right. Evan, give us a quote.
The important thing in science is not so much to obtain new facts as to discover new ways of thinking about them. That was said by William Lawrence Bragg.
Those are the biggest changes in science when we start to think about things in a new way.
Look at Einstein and the constancy of the speed of light. Well, okay, what are the ramifications of that, assuming that it's absolutely true? Yeah. Oh, okay, here's relativity.
Sir William Lawrence Bragg, Australian-born British physicist, X-ray crystallographer, discoverer of the Bragg law of X-ray diffraction, right, Bob? Which is the basic for the determination of crystal structure, for which he shared in the Nobel Prize in Physics 1915. Yes, he was also, of course, knighted, as the title implies, in 1941. And the youngest ever Nobel laureate in physics, 25 years old, and was the director of the Cavendish Laboratory. I love the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge when the discovery of the structure of DNA was reported by Watson and Crick in February 1953. So, an impressive person in the world of science.
Fantastic man. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes, all five
thank
of
you.
Us.
Yeah, full boat this week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.